This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Turkey and Russia exchange more accusations over the shoot-down of a Russian jet fighter. Paris prepares for an international climate conference. Shopping frenzy about to strike the United States.
This is our Super Bowl, and this really is the one time a year that the gloves are off and the competition just heightens.
A world-famous choreographer pushes the boundaries of dance. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says that Turkey's downing of a Russian warplane looks like a planned provocation, but that Russia is not going to war with Turkey. Mr. Lavrov said Wednesday the incident will make Russia reconsider its relationship with Turkey. He canceled a planned trip to Turkey on Wednesday, but did speak with Turkey's foreign minister, and the two agreed to meet in the coming days. Meanwhile, one of the pilots who parachuted from the Russian jet fighter arrived Wednesday at a Russian base in Latakia after being rescued by members of the Syrian army. He denied that the jet had entered Turkey's airspace and insisted the Turkish authorities had issued no warnings to the plane before it was shot down. According to Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the plane crashed in Syria but was still inside Turkey's airspace when it was hit. He said his country is simply defending its security when Turkish fighter planes shot down the jet and that he does not want any escalation with Russia. Middle East analyst Joseph Ulmer of the University of South Carolina told VOA's Victor Beatty that Turkey's action underscores the growing complexity and dangers as the Syrian conflict drags on.
Because what people may skip about this story is that this dogfight, this little battle, took place over an area in Syria where there are about half a million Turkmen tribesmen, which are basically of Turkish origin. And the Turkish president already made a comment that we are there to support our brothers. I'm not sure that the Russians even knew about all that before they intervened. But coming back to your specific comment about Russian pilots, well, you know, I've never been terribly impressed with the quality of Russian pilots. And I will remind you that in 1970, during the fighting between Israel and Egypt over the Suez Canal in what was called at that time the attrition war, the Russian Air Force intervened at one point in time, and in one famous dogfight, five Russian MiG-21 aircraft were brought down by the Israeli Air Force, and since then they have never been involved in this fighting. So, you know, it may not be something new altogether.
The Kremlin said on Tuesday that it viewed the downing of that Russian jet by Turkey as an unfriendly act and was working on a package of measures to respond to such incidents.
I don't know if they really think seriously about having any hostility committed against Turkey directly. It won't be wise on their part. It will be even stupid, I would say. But they can definitely do all kinds of other things. I understand that they are already advising Russian tourists not to go to Turkey. And Russian tourism is over 10% of the entire volume of tourism in Turkey. They also are threatening to cut off the gas supply via Turkey to Europe. So, you know, there may be all kinds of measures that they can take against the Turks. But the real story here is something else, if I may, Victor. And this is that it wasn't supposed to be, theoretically, because the Russians and the Turks, theoretically, are working with the same enemy in Syria, which is ISIS. If you believe that, I've never believed it. The Turks are not working against ISIS. And I'm not sure that the Russians are working against ISIS. The Russians are working against the other rebel groups in Syria that work against Bashar Assad. And the Turks support these groups. So that's where the real collision is between the two countries.
Russia says it's going to continue its air campaign. Can we expect more incursions? Will Russia be more circumspect in its missions?
They will have to be very careful, and they will have to make sure that their pilots are not committing those types of errors, because what this dogfight proved is that the Turkish air defense system and their state of alertness are very well in place, you know. So they have to be very careful about it. The Russians have intensified their aerial bombardments for quite some time already, and according to what I understand, to be the case, there hasn't been any real breakthrough altogether.
I wanted to turn to the meeting between French President Hollande and President Obama at the White House. They agreed to forge a unified front against the Islamic State, and they appealed to Russia to throw its weight behind the global effort to resolve the four-year Syrian conflict.
Well, it's a great statement, of course, of intent, but if they really want to have Russian cooperation, there will have to be a discussion about what will be the fate of Bashar Assad. And obviously, the two sides do not agree on this one. Look, any real solution to Syria has to start by defeating ISIS. But defeating ISIS doesn't mean just a bombarding from the air. It will have to be a boots on the ground, and I don't see anyone is ready to do that.
Joseph Ulmert, Middle East analyst at the University of South Carolina, speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. As France gets ready to host next week's climate conference, some fear the Paris terrorist attacks and global security concerns may cast a shadow over the talks. One man, however, thinks differently. He's France's special climate envoy, who believes the discussions will be closely tied to issues of peace and justice. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
In a few days, dozens of world leaders arrive in Paris for the key climate summit. And Nicolas Hulot, a well-known environmentalist and French President François Hollande's special envoy, says the chances of reaching an ambitious climate change agreement are still uncertain.
Dire que Paris, à ce stade, pourrait être un échec absolu, c'est manquer absolument d'objectivité.
Hulot says complete failure at the UN COP21 climate conference outside Paris is impossible. But real success will depend on a number of criteria, including securing an initial $100 billion in financing to help poorer countries adapt to climate change and taking the steps necessary to switch from fossil to green energy. The overall goal is to cut global greenhouse gas emissions to 2 degrees Celsius or less above pre-industrial levels. Hulot spoke Wednesday to a group of Anglophone reporters in a capital that is still recovering from Europe's worst terrorist attacks in more than a decade. The string of shootings and bombings killed or wounded about 500 people. At least two suspects are still on the loose. A state of emergency remains in place, and French authorities are stepping up security even further for the climate summit.
C'est un risque que le contexte sécuritaire puisse détourner l'attention.
Hulot says there's always a risk the massive security focus could divert attention from reaching global climate goals, but he says he believes the opposite might happen at the conference, since climate change brings new conflicts and threats, like massive population displacements. He says fighting climate change improves chances for greater world peace and justice. U.S. President Barack Obama, who says he will be pushing for a robust climate deal, has also warned a warming planet threatens U.S. national security and the future of many developing countries. In Washington Tuesday, President Hollande, during a meeting with Obama, said going ahead with a climate conference is the best response to the Paris attacks. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The focus of the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign is shifting. Recent public opinion polls show that concerns about national security are on the rise in the wake of the terrorist attacks in Paris. Presidential contenders from both parties are responding. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has details.
For Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, the Paris attacks have reset the presidential campaign, with a focus on protecting the homeland.
I've gone up. Everyone else has gone up. I've gone way up because people view me as the one that are. I'm going to be the best protector. I'm going to fight like hell for your safety.
Republican Marco Rubio argues for a stronger commitment to fight the Islamic State.
Either they win or we win. That is the seriousness of this threat. And the longer we take to wake up to its reality, the harder it's going to be to defeat it and stop it.
Democrat Hillary Clinton also says it's time for a tougher approach.
Our goal is not to deter or contain ISIS, but to defeat and destroy ISIS. And we should be honest about the fact that to be successful, Airstrikes will have to be combined with ground forces actually taking back more territory from ISIS.
The new campaign focus on terrorism and national security could help the Republicans, says Stuart Rothenberg.
But traditionally, foreign policy, you know, the Republicans have been the party of muscular foreign policy, strength, defense. And so anytime there's a question of U.S. vulnerability, it helps the Republicans.
Donald Trump continues to lead the Republican field and seems to be tapping into voter fears, says analyst John Fortier.
He doesn't have a national security background. He says some things that are outrageous. He still is playing into the worries. The worries broadly about immigration, but more specifically, the worries about security and terrorism that flow from that.
This new focus on security may or may not last, says William Galston.
Whether that heightened concern will persist through the 2016 election is another matter, but it is certainly shaping and reshaping the political dialogue here and now, and seems very likely to have an impact on the presidential nominating process.
The fears about terrorism come at a critical time in the campaign as voters prepare to choose party nominees beginning February 1st in Iowa. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, a look at what Black Friday means in the United States. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? Walking for money, literally. It's a new app called Bitwalking. It installs on your smartphone, and with it, you make money just by walking. Using GPS and complicated algorithms, the Bitwalking app converts kilometers into money. You get one virtual dollar for every 8 kilometers walked. This virtual money goes into your Bitwalking account to use for purchases from the app's online marketplace. Japanese investors are the major financial force behind Bitwalking so far, paying most of the $10 million in startup costs. To start, Bitwalking will only be available in 4 places, Japan, Kenya, Malawi, and the United Kingdom. In less developed countries like Malawi, workers in rural areas earn around $45 a month. By tracking their steps, Bitwalking developers say some of these workers could nearly double their income. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossan.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. Pope Francis is in Nairobi, Kenya, at the start of a tour in Africa that also includes stops in Uganda and the Central African Republic. The Pope arrived Wednesday and met with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. VOA correspondent Jill Craig is in Nairobi and spoke with International Edition Susan Yaki about the Pope's day ahead and the mood.
People here are very, very excited, and, you know, even if they're not Catholic, they also see the importance of the Pope visiting their country. And I spoke to a few Muslims even, and, you know, they were also very, very, you know, pleased that the Pope had selected Kenya for his first stop on his African tour. Along the way, you had people singing, you had people dancing, a lot of ladies wearing the traditional congas here, the sort of the scarves wrapped around their waists with the Pope's image on them. And also banners and signs, of course. And every time that a car came by, one of the, you know, the presidential motorcade cars, or, you know, for that matter, even the police or the ambulance, before the Pope showed up, people were cheering and, you know, very, very excited. So the mood here is one of, I would say, of joy.
Well, was the Pope in his little Fiat like he was when he was here in Washington?
Well, that's what we were all thinking. No, actually, the Pope was in a little Honda.
Oh.
So I think he's changed vehicles for this trip.
Okay. Say, besides having fun, there are some serious meetings he's holding there.
First, he'll have Mass at the university, which is sort of his headliner event. But, you know, he does also have the serious meetings that you've mentioned. He will be meeting with an interfaith group. So I think he's got a group of Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, and, you know, maybe some Protestants in there as well. So he'll be meeting with that group later on during his trip. He's also got a trip to the Kangemi slum scheduled. And, you know, the Pope has always, during his papacy, he's sort of talked a lot about poverty and helping the underprivileged, try to make a better life for themselves. And so he's actually going to be visiting a slum. On Friday morning, he'll be visiting Kangemi, and people there are especially excited because that's an area that probably doesn't get as much attention as others, and so I think they're particularly excited that the Pope is visiting. He's got a lot of meetings set up. He's also got a meeting at UNEP, I should mention, where, as we know from his trip to Washington, he definitely has made climate change one of the issues that he's brought up throughout his papacy, and so he will also be meeting with UNEP, and so I think that, he's addressing a lot of serious issues, while at the same time, I think his goal is to, show compassion toward the poor and sort of show people that, show them the correct way to live as opposed to just telling them.
Amid all the excitement, I hate to bring this up, but with all the terrorism reports in the news of late, the security must be really tight.
Yes, it is. The reports that we got from the Kenyan police chief was 10,000 additional police had been brought in for this event. And you can notice that you see it as well around. I mean, normally at a traffic roundabout, you'd have probably four policemen, sort of directing traffic. And now you've got double that, plus more police along the route. And then also many of the streets are closed down entirely based on wherever the Pope is going. So I would say that that the Kenyan security forces say that they've got things under control.
That's VOA's Jill Craig in Nairobi talking earlier with International Edition's Susan Yockey. Time now for our look at the world of social media. G. Abby Lee is here to tell us what's trending on the web. Hi, G.
Hello. And that is the name of the album that broke the records. The latest album by Britain's Adele outsold every other album in 2015 in just 3 days. That means in 3 days, it sold more copies of the album 25 than all the other albums did throughout the entire year. The latest development pushed Taylor Swift's album called 1989 to the second place, which was a best-selling album last year.
Well, we're talking about a lot of numbers here. How many copies are we talking about?
Based on the Nielsen Music Ratings, Adele's 25 sold at least 2.3 million copies earlier this week. Compared to that, T-Swift's 1989 sold about 1.8 million copies this year. Last year, the same album sold more than 3.5 million copies. Now, the two numbers from that album became massive hits, namely Shake It Off and Blank Space.
Maybe the secret is in the title.
But
both of them seem to have numbers in the name. And I heard Adele had some trouble with Twitter recently. What's that all about?
Well, it's actually a funny story. So she's doing really well on Twitter with more than 24 million followers. And she gets up to 180,000 likes per tweet. But she only sent out a dozen tweets so far this year, and I'll tell you why. She's quote-unquote banned from using her own account freely. Adele apparently sent out too many drunk tweets in the past, so her management ordered at least two people to read her messages before making them go live. She used to be much more prolific on Twitter. And Ray, looks like it's a British invasion this week on Twitter. English songwriter Zayn Malik is also in one of the trending hashtags, with hashtag 8 months without Zayn. In the last 24 hours, 30,000 tweets used that hashtag. He left a widely popular boy band, One Direction, in March, and the fans are using that hashtag to show how much they miss him. That's all for me today.
Thanks, G. She tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account at VOA_IE. And you can also follow G on her account at G Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you from Washington. The holiday season is once again upon us. That means retailers and shopping malls around the world are busy with the final decorating touches for the start of the all-important holiday shopping. Here in the United States, it really gets going the Friday after the Thursday Thanksgiving holiday. Retailers call it Black Friday. That's because, for many retailers, it marks the day they finally move from the red, as in losses, and into the black, as in profits. Here's VOA's Mil Arcega.
It's the most profitable time of the year for retailers, accounting for 20 to 30% of annual revenue. And this year, close to 150 million U.S. citizens will go shopping over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, says Kathy Granis Allen with the National Retail Federation.
So this is our Super Bowl, and this really is the one time a year that the gloves are off and the competition just heightens.
To compete, some stores will open early and stay open longer. Nearly all promise big savings to attract the maximum number of shoppers. But this year, some retailers, including Nordstrom, Costco, and others, will stay closed Thanksgiving, while outdoor wear retailer REI stays closed on Black Friday as well. While their profits could take a hit, business author Kevin Paul Scott tells us on Skype the message is about tradition and family values.
And people remember that. And beyond the holidays, when they're buying Mother's Day and Father's Day gifts next May and June, they will remember these retailers, they'll spend more money there, and those retailers win in the long run.
But more people are opting to avoid the crowds. This year, the NRF says more than half of all holiday purchases will be made online, with one in five Americans using a tablet or smartphone. That's the highest since the NRF started asking the question in 2011. Despite tepid sales last month, lower unemployment and rising wages could give Americans more disposable income this year, says economist Gus Fauché on Skype.
They're benefiting from lower gasoline prices as well. That gives them more money to spend on other things, lower home heating costs, so that's good news. We're adding a lot of jobs, seeing stronger wage gains. I think that people are going to be in the mood to spend.
According to the NRF, the average American consumer will spend about $805 on gifts. That's more than $630 billion between November and December, an increase of 3.7% from last year. Mil Arcega, VOA News, Washington.
Choreographer and dancer Twyla Tharp is an American icon, this year celebrating her 50th anniversary in the world of dance. She's won a Tony, two Emmys, and been a Kennedy Center honoree. For her golden anniversary this year, Tharp's been taking a pair of new works on a 17-city tour. Bill Zeeble reports from Dallas, Texas, where the tour began.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown.
In April of 1965, Twyla Tharp, with two colleagues, danced her first work using Petula Clark's popular song, Downtown.
Just listen to the music of the traffic.
She told the Dallas audience that Tank Dive premiered in New York's Hunter College and lasted all of about 4.5 minutes.
Because I figured that's all I knew about a beginning and a middle and an end, and I could get it into that period of time. So if you were late, you kind of missed the whole thing. But that was okay because I think 14 people came. And that's okay too.
Because she knew that she could do it. She's since created hundreds of dances over 5 decades, presenting them on the dance stage, Broadway theaters, for television, and film. On this anniversary tour, she presents not one, but two premieres. Tharp is 74. She does not believe in slowing down.
The point of work is, to me, doing more work. There's always time for the past, and I value the past. Not only my past, but others' past. But the future's got lots of room for the past. The present has only now.
And for now, Tharp says it's time for the world as it ought to be, and for the world as it is, at least according to her. To Bach's well-tempered clavier, Tharp pays tribute to dance giants she learned from: Merce Cunningham, Martha Graham, Jerome Robbins, George Balanchine. Tharp's first work, Preludes and Fugues, presents a world of equality, justice, balance.
People have an overview of tolerance, and that diversity does not separate. It is possible to congregate as a diverse lot. That would be the world as it ought to be. The world as it is had best be approached with humor.
And so the other work, Yowzy, is danced to jazz, with funny interactions between couples and slapstick moves inspired by Tharp's beloved silent film comedies. As she helped pioneer the use of pop, rock, and jazz in serious dance, Tharp also blended modern and classical ballet moves in her work. That used to shock the dance world, but no more. Dancer John Celia, who matured with the Classical American Ballet Theater, joined Tharp 16 years ago.
I love being a ballet dancer, but sometimes I disagree with how marginalized it is. People have a certain idea of it, and if it goes out of the boundaries, they reject it.
Celia embraced it, welcoming the challenge of dancing in Tharp's company and learning to be more creative than he'd been allowed at ABT. Combining dance styles and musical genres opened up the art form, says Lily Weiss. The longtime professional dancer is the artistic director at Dallas's Booker T. Washington High School. It's consistently among the nation's best art schools. She says Tharp, the pioneer, is the role model for pushing boundaries.
That's why she was so accessible and so successful, I think, is she not only spoke to the patron who wants to be moved by art, but she spoke to a patron that enjoyed watching accessible dance.
Tharp is also just really funny. She was a pre-med student before deciding she could learn more about the human body through dance. Other than honorary degrees, she doesn't have a PhD or medical degree, but she says she's a doctor of sorts and pounds the microphone for emphasis.
I do consider myself a doctor, and one of my missions is that when an audience leaves our theater, that audience needs to feel better leaving than it did coming in. And if it doesn't, we haven't done our job.
Twyla Tharp's anniversary prescription to audiences has been these two new works and two past pieces on a triumphant national tour. For VOA News, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
And that'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The first Thursday in November is a national day of Thanksgiving in the United States. The tradition is a very old one, dating to the arrival of the first English settlers in North America in the 17th century, who, after their first successful harvest, paused to celebrate their bounty and give thanks for surviving their first terrible winter in what was then a wilderness. Falling in the autumn, Thanksgiving has much in common with harvest holidays in other nations and cultures, such as Vietnam's Chung Tu celebration and Hamoo, the annual Yam Festival in Ghana. Still, with its turkey dinners, family gatherings, football games, and parades, there's something about the day that is distinctively American. Together with July 4th, when the United States marks its independence from Great Britain, it's a truly national holiday that includes all citizens in a common purpose, regardless of religious, political, or ethnic persuasion. It is also a time for people to look back at the year, take stock, and think about the future. With our nation dealing with crises in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and West Africa, the looming uncertainties likely will be on many minds today. President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed the first official Thanksgiving amid similar serious circumstances, the American Civil War. But like their colonial ancestors, Americans are essentially an optimistic people. Surrounded by friends and family, today as in the past, they will enter into the spirit of the day, giving thanks for life's blessings and the promise of the future, living in a free land.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.